This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson, the producer of this week's episode. In part four of our series on the Israel lobby, we look at the Anti-Defamation League with journalist James Bamford. But first, news. After Israel's targeted attack on a humanitarian aid convoy killed seven World Central Kitchen workers in Gaza, the aid agency ANIRA announced April 2nd it is suspending its relief operation there. The seven deaths follow the still unexplained killing of an ANIRA staff member the month before, and ANIRA said the escalating risk to the safety of workers delivering food and emergency supplies in Gaza is forcing it to take the unprecedented step of pausing operations. ANIRA is the second largest humanitarian organization working in Gaza after UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency. Despite looming famine in Gaza, the United States suspended aid to UNRWA after Israel claimed that a dozen of UNRWA's employees in Gaza had ties to Hamas. Israel's destruction of Gaza's biggest hospital has ripped the heart out of the enclave's healthcare system, the World Health Organization said April 2nd. Over a two-week period, Israel carried out a massive military operation at El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The exact number of casualties is still unknown, but the human rights organization EuroMed Monitor reports its initial investigations confirmed hundreds of dead bodies found inside the hospital and in the surrounding area, some with their heads and limbs severed and others burned. At least 22 patients were killed in their hospital beds during the raid, and others were deprived of food, medical care, and supplies. Israel claims it killed hundreds of militants during the raid. Satellite imagery shows the near total devastation of the hospital today. More than 600 British lawyers and judges, including three former UK Supreme Court justices, are calling for the government to halt arms sales to Israel, which they say could make Britain complicit in genocide and the violation of international humanitarian law. The 17-page letter they sent to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak saying the sale of weapons to Israel fell short of international law was backed by two of the country's top intelligence experts who argued that Britain needed to use its leverage to persuade Israel and the United States to change course. My guest today is the award-winning investigative journalist, author, and documentary film producer James Bamford. He has written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, Harper's, The New Republic, and many other publications. For 10 years, he was the investigative producer of ABC's World News Tonight. He is the leading authority on the United States intelligence agencies, particularly the National Security Agency, about which he has written four acclaimed books: The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory. His most recent book, published in 2023, is Spy Fail: Foreign Spies, Moles, Saboteurs, and the Collapse of America's Counterintelligence. James Bamford, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Well, thank you, Margo. Thank you for having me on your show.
You wrote an article published January 31st in The Nation magazine titled The Anti-Defamation League, Israel's Attack Dog in the United States, in which you draw attention to some of the hyperbolic claims made by the ADL about rising incidents of anti-Semitism since the war in Gaza began in October. Claims that have been disputed by some of the ADL's own staff, according to articles both in Jewish Currents magazine and The Guardian newspaper. Your article also discusses the ADL's dubious past illicitly surveilling U.S. citizens, which you were personally involved in investigating. I want to get to the ADL today and what it's saying about anti-Semitism, but let's start with the past and the sentence that jumped out to me and will, I think, jump out to other readers too. You write, "For much of its history, the ADL has operated in the United States as if it were a hostile intelligence organization, which in essence it was." Could you talk about what leads you to write that?
In the 1990s, I was the investigative producer for ABC News, and we did an investigation of the ADL. We were actually tagging along on the sort of the backside of an investigation that the district attorney's office in San Francisco was doing. What they were investigating was the ADL's domestic spying, basically. They had hired a number of people for decades, actually, around the country. And that was what they did. They spied on other organizations, Palestinian organizations, Arab American organizations. The ADL agents would go to these meetings and either infiltrate them and take notes and so forth and get the license numbers of the cars outside. They also had informants within the, for example, within the San Francisco Police Department. One of the police officers that worked there, a guy named Gerard, he passed on a great deal of information, confidential information from the police and also from the FBI to the ADL. And these were details about private organizations that were having private meetings. There was nothing illegal about anything. And they were passing on the information to the ADL, who would then pass it on to the Israeli government. So it was a spying operation.
And just so listeners will understand the extent of the ADL surveillance, while Arabs were a primary focus of the spying, the ADL surveilled hundreds of organizations, including labor unions, civil rights groups, social justice groups. It surveilled the NAACP, the AFL-CIO, the United Farm Workers, Greenpeace, Jewish peace groups, reporters from the Los Angeles Times. It spied on 960 organizations. My question for you, James, is internal ADL documents reveal that at least at some point, the United States became aware of this spying and was seemingly okay with it. Why did the United States government find this acceptable to begin with, that one group of U.S. citizens would spy on another? And then why did it find it acceptable that a domestic organization would turn over information on U.S. citizens to a foreign government?
First of all, the U.S. government almost never prosecutes individuals dealing with Israeli spying, unless it's an American in the U.S. that's caught red-handed with documents in his hand. But for years, they just sort of turn a blind eye to a lot of the espionage that goes on in the U.S. by Israel. I write a lot about that in my most recent book, Spy Fail. But that's just the way it is. In this case, it was fairly unusual that at least the district attorney's office in the San Francisco area decided to open an investigation and pursued it. Eventually, they settled it sort of out of court, and the ADL agreed not to do the spying anymore and so forth. So, but at least it was investigated. I actually, with a colleague of mine from ABC, we flew all the way out to a small little island off the Philippines called Palawan, and interviewed Inspector Gerard, or Detective Gerard, who was the person that was passing a lot of the documents from the San Francisco Police Department and the FBI, which he had access to the ADL. And to prevent being arrested, he fled to this little island called Palawan, basically to hide out. And we flew there and he talked to us, basically, and eventually he went back to San Francisco and turned himself in. So it was very interesting sort of seeing this underside of the ADL, because that's a side that very few people see. All they ever see is pretty much the handouts and the propaganda that they are always putting out. This is sort of the underside of the ADL.
I'm assuming that the FBI must not have known of the surveillance, or that it must not have known that the United States government was okay with the ADL spying, or it wouldn't have begun its investigation. What branches of the U.S. government would have been informed of this spying, or what officials?
It wasn't anything secret about it. The San Francisco District Attorney's Office made an announcement that they were investigating the ADL and that they were investigating Gerard, for example, for passing on FBI documents. So there was no question that they didn't know about it. They could have brought federal charges, but they didn't. And that's one of the problems, is when it comes to anything dealing with Israel, the U.S. shies away from taking any action. And here in this case, they just said pretty much, I think, we'll leave it to the district attorney's office. I mean, as long as they're investigating it. But then in the end, it was pretty much settled out of court, as opposed to people being brought before a trial, which is a lot of the ways it's handled when anything involves Israel. But we did on World News Tonight with Peter Jennings on ABC News, we did a long investigation. We interviewed Gerard out in the Philippines. We interviewed a number of other people, including a former member of the ADL, who admitted that the ADL had agents around the country that were doing the spying. He said that on camera, full face. So we interviewed a number of people, both in and out of the ADL, and that was the conclusion. But it was even worse, because in addition to passing the information on to the ADL, these spies that the ADL had around the country, they actually had code names. The spies would not only pass on the information to ADL, but they would also, there was an agreement where they would pass on the information to the apartheid South African government, because there was a very close cooperation between Israel and the apartheid South African government during the 1980s, for example, and early 90s. They would pass on information that dealt with anti-apartheid demonstrations, anti-apartheid meetings. They would have secret meetings with members of the South African Intelligence Service. So this was a fairly elaborate spying operation, since the information basically was going to not only the ADL, but to two other foreign countries.
And why did the ADL undertake that relationship with the intelligence service of South Africa?
Well, at the time, South Africa was one of their closest countries, probably outside of the United States. It was the closest ally that Israel had. Not only was it passing on the secret information it was getting in the United States, it was also delivering nuclear materials to South Africa. South Africa was involved in developing a nuclear weapon, and the Israelis had nuclear materials that the South Africans could use. So they had an agreement where they passed on these nuclear materials to South Africa in order to help them build a nuclear weapon. And in return, South Africa passed on a great deal of uranium, or what they call yellow cake, to Israel in order to help fuel their nuclear weapons facility and so forth. So there was this long-standing close relationship, very close relationship, and that was one aspect of it, passing on information that might be useful to the South African government.
You mentioned that few people are ever prosecuted in the United States for espionage on behalf of Israel or any other illicit activities related to Israel. Could you talk about why?
There's a longstanding sort of agreement that the U.S. doesn't do things that embarrasses Israel. So they handle a lot of these things under the table. I wrote an article, cover story for The Nation magazine a year ago, I guess it was in March, and it was based on a chapter in my book where I show how the Israeli government had an agent come over from Israel to try to infiltrate the Trump campaign as it was running for president back in 2016. The U.S. had that information because I got the FBI documents under the Freedom of Information Act that showed that the meetings were taking place. It showed a lot of the details. This was coming directly from FBI files, but they never brought any charges against anybody. Brushed it under the rug. That's what they do virtually every case. The only exceptions are where there is actual espionage involving an American citizen who passes on classified documents and they discover it, then they'll prosecute the Americans, but then they don't go after any of the Israelis.
Is there reason to believe that the ADL continues to surveil Americans?
It's hard to say. The problem is that it's so rare when any government agency actually investigates the ADL. They never fired anybody because of the scandal. The head of the ADL at the time basically got a raise in his salary because of it. He certainly wasn't fired and basically got a promotion, if anything else, because of it. So there was no real internal gnashing of teeth that we shouldn't be doing this. They may have stopped it, but there's really no way of knowing how much they stopped or whether they stopped or not.
If you're just tuning in, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to investigative journalist and author James Bamford about his January 31st article in The Nation magazine about the Anti-Defamation League. In it, he examines the ADL's history of spying on U.S. citizens and statistics about anti-Semitic incidents in the United States that conflate anti-Israel protests with anti-Semitism.
You think of the ADL as more a very staunch supporter of Israel or really an agent of Israel?
It's long been an agent of Israel in a lot of senses. I mean, it's basically a propaganda arm of Israel. I mean, that was very clear when they actually had employees of ADL in New York walk out in protest because the ADL, they were saying, was focusing, well, in their statistics, they would put out all these statistics about all these anti-Semitic actions all over the U.S. And the problem was they were including in those anti-Semitic activities that they were compiling all these statistics, they were including protests against the Israeli government's war in Gaza. It wasn't anti-Semitic activities in the U.S. In other words, somebody attacking somebody because they're Jewish. They were having protests over a war that was killing lots and lots of people. So you even had people from the ADL who thought that was really bad activity and decided to quit and decided to leave and actually publicly explain what was going on.
When I asked you about whether the ADL is more an ally or an agent, I wondered if the ADL coordinates statements and policies with Israeli officials.
It's hard to say because you'd have to be listening to their conversations. In the past, there's been a lot of cooperation, obviously, because the ADL is, in essence, represents a lot of the people in Israel. They get a lot of support from the Israeli government. They get a lot of support from pro-Israeli people. So yeah, there's a very close relationship to it. How much goes on is very difficult to say since it's a private organization.
Much of what we've been talking about is not secret. We did a program back in 2021 about the ADL's history of surveilling U.S. citizens. The ADL has never explained the methodology behind its statistics.
Recently said that since the attack on Israel, October 7th, that anti-Semitic incidents have risen 360%, which, as you pointed out, the ADL's own staff members have disputed.
Why does the mainstream media continue to give such credibility to the ADL, quoting its statistics without any challenge or question about their validity?
I was the investigative producer for ABC for 10 years. I've written enormous amounts of information for mainstream media publications from the New York Times, the Washington Post, a lot of other places. And there's sort of an internal decision-making process where they're going to sort of turn a blind eye to a lot of the things that Israel has been doing in the past. I mean, that just happens to be a fact. The show I work for, World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, was one of the few that didn't really uphold that. And we did a lot of investigative pieces on Israel and spying in the U.S. and so forth. But that's just a matter of fact. They don't want to maybe offend a lot of their listeners or readers or whatever who happen to be contributors or whatever. I'm not on the executive levels of the mainstream media, so I can't speak for them. I don't know why, but I've constantly written about the fact that they do turn a blind eye to a lot of the activities that take place in Israel that I think a lot of people would be objectionable about. The whole war in Gaza, for example, it wasn't until several months into it that a lot of the mainstream press started to take the side of the Palestinians to a large degree after they started seeing the horrendous activity of the Israeli military. I mean, they accept the ADL's statistic just because it's the ADL and there's nobody really telling them anything different. They don't investigate the ADL and they just accept what they are given. And it's only because the internal people at the ADL, the actual workers there that were actually involved in collecting the statistics, came out and said that the statistics are all largely fabricated in terms of the numbers, since they don't reflect what the statements indicate, that these are anti-Semitic incidents. They represent, a lot of them represent anti-war protests, not anti-Semitic protests. A lot of that never came out until the employees themselves walked out of ADL and helped press releases and so forth.
At the level of individual journalists, are individual journalists just self-censoring themselves when they write about the ADL?
I'm a writer. I'm not out there with the daily press every day or whatever. So I don't really talk to the daily press about why they do certain things. So I don't know, but I know that if you're working for the daily press, you have editors, and the editors have managers, and they have vice presidents, and they have presidents, and up and down the line, there's a sort of an unwritten rule that you're probably not going to get something on the air a lot of times if it's very critical of Israel. That's just the way it has been in the past. I worked for ABC, for Peter Jennings particularly, and he was not like that. So I never had those problems. I was over in Israel. I've been shot at by the settlers over there. I've done a lot of reporting on Israel. I've never had really any pushback myself. I can always speak for myself. I can sort of see out there that there's all these stories that could be done that aren't being done. And the reason is, I assume, is politics within the mainstream media.
I think some people look at the overwhelming support in the Congress for Israel and see it as really captive to the Israel lobby. Do you think the intelligence services in this country are also captive to the lobby?
It's hard to specifically say about the intelligence services, since they get their orders from civilians, basically, who run the government, the president, the vice president, and so forth, and Congress. I think what they do is they see the writing on the wall that nobody really wants to know much about what the Israelis are doing, and then they just follow in course. I've interviewed numerous FBI agents over the years, particularly on this issue. Street agents, in other words, the ones that just work cases for the FBI. Interviewed the heads of the counterintelligence division of the FBI. And they all basically say the same thing, that they're frustrated because they would like to take a lot of these cases to court for prosecution. But once the cases are developed and they have enough information, they feel, to make a prosecution or bring a case to court. But once it goes over to the Justice Department, which is far more political, it just disappears. In other words, they never hear back from it. They just move on to the next case because nothing is done. So that's the frustration I've heard from a lot of the people who work counterintelligence for the FBI and would like to take some of these cases up the ladder for prosecution, but are stymied because the Justice Department really doesn't want to do these cases for political reasons.
The title of your article in The Nation is The ADL, Israel's Attack Dog in the United States. Now, of course, writers don't always put on titles for their articles. Does that reflect your own view of the ADL? And is it fair to say that the ADL sees its role as patrolling what is and what is not acceptable to say about Israel and weaponizes charges of anti-Semitism to that end?
They use that seat of power there to intimidate people against writing about Israel, because if they have a phrase in there or a word in there that ADL objects to, their editor or their publisher or whoever will be getting a note or a call from the ADL, and they're very afraid of being accused of being anti-Semitic. What I show in the article is that the ADL has been abusing that privilege by, first of all, spying on innocent people in the U.S., giving information to foreign governments, and then slanting their statistics when it comes to the numbers of anti-Semitic incidents. And if you do that, then it's not very far to try to intimidate journalists or journalist organizations into not writing critically about Israel, because then you may be hearing or getting some public criticism from the ADL. And what the people who left ADL say is that ADL manufactures a lot of these numbers simply to get the attention of the press and to throw the American public into a wrong view of certain articles or certain speeches or whatever, and certain statistics that they are hoping to swing to their own side.
Daryl Lee, a professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, has written a report published February 21st by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal, a nonprofit that defends Palestinian activists, that looks at the role of Zionist organizations, and particularly the ADL, in promoting and shaping early U.S. terrorism laws, laws that were rooted in an anti-Palestinian agenda. He points out The first mention of terrorism in a federal statute in 1969 dealt specifically with restricting humanitarian aid to Palestinians. The first U.S. government terrorism blacklist was championed by Israel supporters and has been used primarily against governments supporting Palestinian resistance. You've done so much work on intelligence agencies and particularly the NSA. Does your research indicate that intelligence agencies have also had this anti-Palestinian agenda?
Intelligence agencies are so secretive, and it's very, very difficult getting any information out. I've never really explored that particular issue intensively throughout the intelligence community because I've had to focus on lots of other issues. The Israelis are very, very good in terms of signals intelligence, the equivalent of the U.S. National Security Agency. They have an equivalent organization over there called Unit 8200. They've developed a sophisticated eavesdropping capability. So the U.S. NSA and Unit 8200 share a lot of information. We give them a lot of information. They give us a great deal of information. That's one of the reasons why the U.S. is very reluctant to take actions against the Israeli government in the United States. They usually handle these things more quietly behind the scenes, as they did with a lot of the things involving the ADL. The NSA did with Israel something that they have never done with any other country, and that's send this information unredacted involving American citizens, which is really outrageous because if you're an American citizen, you don't expect that NSA is going to be eavesdropping on your conversations, your phone conversations, or your email, and then sending unredacted transcripts to a foreign government, particularly the Israeli government, who are using that information against the Palestinians, passing on the names of Palestinian Americans in the United States to the Israeli government. And these are communications between these people and people living in Palestine or other places. It was very damaging to these Americans. And it only came out that this was happening because of a number of the Israeli military people who were involved in this, who were doing the intercepts and doing the eavesdropping, protested. I think there were at least 50 or more who decided to basically walk out, and they held a protest. And it was an extremely rare incident where you have actual people working for a very secret organization not only walk out in protest, but then publicly explain why they were protesting and what was going on. And so they explained that they were doing this because they didn't like the way that the Israeli government was illegally and harmfully spying on the Palestinians. And what made it even more unusual is these were people who were actually in the military. These weren't just civilians. And so I wrote about that in the New York Times.
James Bamford, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, great. Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
That was journalist and author James Bamford. His article, The Anti-Defamation League, Israel's Attack Dog in the U.S., appeared in The Nation magazine January 31st.
If you missed part of this episode, you can go to our podcast or to our program page on the KKFI website at kkfi.org.
There you'll find an archive of past episodes, including two in July 2021. They take another look at the ADL's checkered past and why activists have launched a Drop the ADL campaign.
This is Understanding Israel-Palestine.